I was just looking at an essay that kind of says that the film is quite different than the book. And so that might be more Kubrick than Nabokov, because my after reading Anna, my take would be that he's definitely more interested in this idea of nymphet or this the Edenic.
Right.
Yeah, there's something that he's really taken with, and it's typified by a 12-year-old girl somehow. But I don't know that it's
Is
necessarily s like explicitly sexual, even though it's completely draped. Like this book we just read, Otta, was just covered in sex.
right,
You
yeah.
know that there was a whole, like, a bunch of people got, I don't know, they had this reaction to Lolita when Kubrick did it because they were looking at the girl Sue Lyon's age and they were like, she looks so old. This isn't accurate. But if you read in the book, from what I remember, she's described as actually looking older than she is. Like, he makes it a point at somewhere when he's
Yeah,
introducing her.
that's the point he makes about Ada in that book as well, that she's very young but very mature at the same time.
Yeah, like Jack Nicholson in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, being, I don't know, she was 13 going on 30, Doc. I don't know, you know. But.
It's funny, Doug, that you mentioned Crying a Lot 49, because I was just skimming these wiki page, and Lolita's referenced in the Crying of Lot 49, in the lyrics to a song by that band
Oh,
Paranoids.
the Paranoids.
And so
Wow.
the lyrics say, "What chance has a lonely surfer boy for the love of a surfer chick, with all these Humbert Humbert cats coming on so big and sick? For me, my baby was a woman. For him, she's just another nymphet." So that's
Wow.
kind of on the nose.
Oh, so it's just to keep weaving this
And
tapestry.
Pynchon, sorry, really quick. Pynchon was famously a student of Nabokov at, or he took a lecture of his, or I don't know,
Cornell, yeah.
at Cornell.
Cornell.
And Nabokov did a bunch of lectures on Ulysses.
Ah.
Well, so David Foster Wallace said that he wasn't influenced, like he had never read The Crying of Lot 49 when, was it The Broom of the System is his first book?
Yeah.
That was a lie.
Yeah.
He had read it.
He's lying. He
Oh,
lied.
really? How did you find that?
That was what his biographer said. Like they were really,
Oh,
he
yeah.
was really into Pynchon.
He just didn't want
Yeah.
like he didn't want to
The
just
anxiety
because
of
everybody
influence.
was telling him, "Oh, he's the next Pynchon. He's the Pynchon. Have you ever read Pynchon?" So he probably just like, "No, I've never fucking heard of the guy." It's like, "Yeah, I've fucking read Pynchon. Of course I." The entire tradition that I'm coming out of, but I'm still my own kind of writer. So, but anyway, that's
Hey guys, I'll be back in 20 minutes if you're still here, but I gotta step away. All right.
Okay.
Okay.
And
well, just to go back to,
oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, go
I
ahead.
did.
Go ahead. No, please go ahead.
I just wanted to continue on with the pension thing for a bit. Is the Broom of the System like Crying a Lot 49? Does anyone know that, or has anyone read both of them?
It's more like Gravity's Rainbow than Crying a Lot 49. But it is extremely like filled with similar kind of names and puns and jokey jokes and but it's more philosophical, and it's like influence. It's basically like a novelization of Wittgenstein's whole philosophy.
Right.
And I have not read the whole thing, but at the time it came out, it was kind of marketed as the heir apparent to Pynchon, because it's a big, complicated book.
It's a long book as well.
Yeah, it's pretty long. It's
Yeah.
400, 500 pages.
Right.
It
And
has
some people
the
cheeky.
protagonist is a young woman, and she's a telephone switchboard operator.
Right. Yeah, that's
It seems
probably.
like there's there's sort of this hardcore that still say that's his best book.
Who? I don't agree, but he kind of dismissed it later in life. It's
Yeah,
kind of
he
yeah
really
yeah
did. Yeah.
I mean, it was literally his college dissertation. So.
Well, no, I mean, so in what I learned was that he kind of, he was able to get this book published while he was in college. Mm-hmm. Oh, you're right. Okay. So as far as the philosophy stuff, so as an MFA student, he was able to procure an agent and get a work published, even though, you know, it's like to the, like he had no support. And so he was kind of ostracized for this. Because he was
at his college, at the school he was going to,
yeah, in Arizona, because he was so much smarter than them, but he didn't want to play ball with them. Like
he acted smarter than them. I think he would probably take issue with that later. He's like, but he was, yeah. I mean, they were all realists and traditional fiction people, and he wanted to do the metafiction thing, and so. But I think everything. Well, never mind. This is off topic.
Is anything off topic now?
Well, all the books we read are all connected.
Too far. Far away from Nabokov.
Well, so here's an interesting thought, just to like take a hard right away from books. My wife wouldn't even watch this film with me. And when I asked Lacey if she wanted to play, she's like, well, maybe I'll listen to the chat. It's like, this might be, like, I was really curious, but there's something.
Why? Because of the whole subject matter?
It's beyond the pale.
I think the culture has really shifted. Like, there was a movie I watched. It's Noah Baumbach's first film. It's called Kicking and Streaming. It has Eric Stoltz in it. It's kind of fun. It was from like
great film. Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that a pajama top you're wearing? No.
Yeah.
With I love that they start a book club in that movie too, and then I don't know what his name
Grover
is.
Grover doesn't fucking read the book.
He or, doesn't read.
Yeah. Oh no, it's the other guy. No one read the book or yeah.
Yeah. Right, Eric Stoltz. But that's where I got my joke.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, it was fucking Eric Stoltz sitting there. Like, and he was like, he was the only person who had read it, right?
You didn't read the book? Right. It was like a McMurtry, I think All the Pretty Horses or Blood Meridian or something like that. It's like, yeah, I felt the same way. The blood and the violence and the sexual eroticism, you know. anyway, the point is that in that movie, one of the college students, or no, they graduated from college, they don't want to get on with their life, but he starts dating this high school girl, and like maybe that wasn't a big deal in the 90s, but it seems like we've like our brains won't even go there anymore. Like the culture has completely shifted.
I keep getting older. They stay the same age.
That was
one thing about the high school girls. Right.
What Linklater?
It was Dazed and Confused.
Linklater. Yeah.
Dazed and Confused. The film 25th Hour also has that plot line where the Edward Norton character is dating a high school girl. So yeah, it seems like there's been a huge. I can't imagine like this Playboy cover that I just saw and anything like this coming out. I mean, it would be.
That musician Miley Cyrus music video on it, because that's more extreme than that cover, and that's recent. That was like 2 years ago or something.
But, wait, yeah, David, can you say that again? Sorry, what was that?
There's a musician that I that named themselves after that Playboy model, and they're like they made a music video, which is why I thought to pair their album with that film that she was in, because that, you know, she's on that cover because she was in this movie. So that's the context. So they were like, oh, how do we show Alice in Wonderland? And they were like, oh, she's a little girl in the bedroom with a fucking bunny. But anyways. The music video that person made is way more extreme than that freaking cover, and that was like recent. So, but you know, I mean,
what's the name of the artist?
Christine, just spelled the same way with a K. But I can send you. I never put it onto the website because I didn't want to risk somebody being like flagging it or being like, this isn't okay. Even though, you know, I have some heavy hitting stuff there, but I was like, yeah, putting an X-rated thing from the 70s, although it looks super cheesy now, is still what it is. So I didn't want to risk that. But I can send you a link to it in the Dropbox. if anyone's interested, but yeah, or I can find
it. I'd like to see it for you.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say I typed in Christine here, and the first thing that came up when Google's the suggested result was Christine Ford. And so we're just to your point, Doug. I mean, this cultural point, it's like there's been a huge, you know, shift in Me Too and these whole
she's from movements. She has a place in Santa Cruz. She's where I'm from. I recognized her when she was on the stand, and I was like, or it wasn't really the stand. That wasn't court. That was a job, whatever it was, the hearing. And I was like, oh, she's so familiar. And I was like, wait a minute. She's not like a public figure. Why does she look so familiar? And then I found out afterwards, she actually mentions Aptos, where I live, in the during the hearing at one point.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But anyways, whatever.
What I was saying, though, is so, you know, Twin Peaks, that was a 90s show. And so Laura is 17 and she's sleeping with all these different men. Right, you've got Dr. Jacoby,
although not in explicit, like, and I
that
mean,
was not metaphorical sex. She was having
it wasn't, but
with
not
Jacques
shown.
And Leo. Oh, right. But when Mark Frost updated, he made her 18, and just to give it just an air of legality, like
it's such a kind of a cop out, if you ask me. I mean, yeah, we have changed, but. It doesn't mean we're not, you don't see the sexualization of very young women constantly on TV and in the culture. And I mean, you know, I don't know. It's on one hand, things have changed, but on the other hand, things often stay the same or get worse.
You know, 15 is the legal age of consent in Sweden. And you'll sometimes see like older people with younger people, like, and you can see what's going on, and they'll get like negative looks from people, you know, but it's technically legal. So, but it's an interesting thing to observe. And like, I was, you know, I saw it one day where I was in like kind of a mall outdoor area, and this like this couple walked by, and I was, she must have been, you know, maybe 15, maybe 16 or whatever. And he was like in his 50s. And I saw the looks that they were getting from people, but they looked genuinely happy. And I was like, what is the driving thing that people are pissed off about? And I think it's that they know that they're not going to have a permanent situation. Like, they look at them and it's like, it's cause for judgment, because they're like, oh, well, that's going to end in a bad way. And I don't know. I looked at him. I was kind of like, well, she's happy for now and he's happy for now. Groovy. Maybe we'll just, you know, whatever. But it's, I don't know. It's interesting. We have different ideas around different parts of the world about what's appropriate and what isn't, you know.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
But the other thing is, Doug, you were saying that this is kind of an oncoming thing at the time of Lolita into the 60s. But I think that these kind of networks like that Quilty represented go way further back. You know, it's not something that was sort of introduced in the 60s.
The way they were portrayed in the film, or like, because he's got the camera and he's a Hollywood writer, you know, and his dance. So like, there was something strangely bizarre. Like you meet the Peter Sellers character dancing with his vampire girlfriend who doesn't, you know, that felt like David Lynch.
In Dark Plains.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's amazing that you bring that up, Doug, because the Lynch plot, the more I think about it, to Twin Peaks, I mean, there's a lot of similarities to this, just the context of this movie. I mean, networks of power, men passing around high school girls. It's striking, you know, and I'm sure Lynch saw this movie and is playing, you know, knows what he's tapping into in terms of the tradition, you know, the artistic tradition, but... Yeah, that's it. I think it's quite accurate, you know, because it's other girls too. It's like Laura Palmer, but doesn't she have a friend that goes with her? And it seems like it's established, I guess.
Sure,
hiring
one-eyed Jacks. Yeah, mm-hmm. Freshly scented from the perfume counter.
Mm-hmm. I didn't watch like the new Twin Peaks. Thing. I saw like a couple of them, you know. I want to see more, but I know that they had this whole thing about like the nuclear bomb, and then just like went there with it. And it's funny because I don't know, you're relating to Lolita, but then I was like, at the time when I was hearing it described, like I had a coworker who couldn't hold back telling me all these little developments, and that was part of one of the reasons I think I didn't finish it, was that I was like, oh, you just gave me major spoiler alert. But anyways, I don't know. I was relating it to Dr. Strangelove, you know. But yeah, my favorite line in Lolita is when Peter Sellers is like, gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room. The best line in Lolita.
I agree. One of them.
In Lolita.
I don't know. I'm like, you guys were talking about like the Russian thing with Nabokov. Like, is he like a, I don't know where you're completely going with that. But if you can kind of like apply the two, like in terms of like where Lolita was like coming from, and then like what happens with Dr. Strangelove, and also the subtext of Dr. Strangelove that was admitted. Mm-hmm. Like somebody kept on inquiring into the meaning of Dr. Strangelove in letters to Kubrick, and like we have the letter where he explained that the whole thing was like a sexual metaphor that just builds, and the nuclear war at the end was like, you know, camp the climax or whatever. There was your camp climax. But I don't know.
Preserving the precious bodily fluids.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's like, that's like the frustration of Humbert. Like he's like going through this whole, I don't know.
But so that would be a interesting thing to go down. So I don't know that I've seen Spartacus all the way through. I definitely really enjoyed
Well, the ending's the best part, dude.
I don't know that I may have seen it. So we got Paths of Glory, which I definitely saw and really appreciated it. And it felt more in line with Lolita. Dr. Strangelove. So do you think that's where you start getting more of the Kubrick character in the film? Do you guys feel it in Lolita, or do you feel it like...
The Kubrick character? What do you mean?
Of Kubrick.
Finds his voice. Like, oh, so,
I,
like,
well, I think he's had his voice from the very beginning, but that's me.
It felt like a Hitchcock film.
Since Fear and Desire, or what?
Yeah, from Day of the Fight.
Yeah,
from his photographs. But no, I know what you mean. Yeah, I think Strangelove would probably be where you start. I mean, Paths of Glory, you see it in, like, the tracking shots and certain aspects of the plot, I guess.
They're both funny tragedies. Like, that's the thing. Like, and they're really complimentary. Like, Dr. Strangelove and Lolita seem to, like, you know, seems like supposedly Dr. Strangelove wasn't supposed to be a comedy. And then it became one because Peter Sellers was just so goddamn funny and they just ran with it. And then, like, Lolita, like, people take that as, like, a really serious thing. Like, when Adrian Lin did it, he tried to be super serious. And it can't help but be funny. No, like,
it's hilarious. It's,
like, his blunder, like, his fuck-ups, like, you're just like, oh, my God, what are you doing, guy? Like, I don't know. You have to laugh at him. And, like, to get somebody to laugh at something so serious feels, like, almost, like, therapeutic. And then, like, the same thing is true for Dr. Strangelove, but it's, like, the fear of nuclear war and, like, you know, the Russian, you know, insanity, like, what's, you know, I don't know, like, the Cold War freak out. And they're actually like, how do you make it something that people can actually laugh at? And it's strange, too, like, you know, people have this whole thing with Alice in Wonderland applying it to the assassination of Kennedy. And then, you know, you are aware of this, I'm sure. We've discussed that at length on Always Record, but I think that that's a thing. Is that just, like, a thing that we have, or is that, like, a thing, like...
What
that people talk about. Alice in Wonderland. Strange. Yeah, okay. And so it's funny that, like, when Dr. Strangelove came out, like, the first showing of it, even before, like, the official whatever, there was, like, a sneak show, and it, like, got canceled. The day and year that Kennedy was killed. They were going to do, technically, the first screening of Dr. Strangelove, and then it was postponed, which is also the day that the Beatles came out with their equivalent of Meet the Beatles, which was with the Beatles. So, like,
Aldous Huxley died.
Yeah, I'm sure, Alex, you could probably lay out more of those than I'm aware of. But
I
mean,
I was just actually the other day kind of realizing how there's that, and then there's of course Eyes Wide Shut, which came out on the day that JFK Jr. died.
Right, which is also Alice. And Bill is the name of the lizard. And Helena, the daughter, is the name of the teacher in Alice in Wonderland. And she starts out in the movie getting a lesson, just like Alice was getting a lesson at the beginning of Alice in Wonderland. But anyway.
But then there's also 2001, which came out on the day that Martin Luther King was shot. And if you want to go even further, The Shining came out, you know, just a few days after Mount St. Helens. So it's like...
Oh, The Shining came out the day after Pac-Man.
Yeah, Pac-Man. But then Mount St. Helens was like still belching, you know, smoke, having killed someone named Harry S. Truman in the Pacific Northwest, if you want to relate it to Twin Peaks again. But so it's like weird how these Kubrick movies seem to correspond with these like massive events of massive cultural kind of significance. There's always a Kubrick movie there. I'd have to go through the other ones to see what else. I think Clockwork Orange might be related to Apollo 17. If I can remember that, I might be a year off. Yeah, I'm a year off.
Who killed Harry S. Truman?
Mount St. Helens.
Alex, real quick. So.
Oh, it was a different. It was a different Harry S. Truman.
Yeah, there's Harry S. Truman. They dropped a bomb, and then there's Harry S. Truman who was vaporized on Mount St. Helens. And then there's Harry S. Truman of Twin Peaks.
There's Twin Peaks. That's what I was going to say. The Twin Peaks, but in the new Twin Peaks, it goes to this idea of Lolita connected with Strangelove, and the idea that somehow the bomb and the 1950s are connected, because the bomb goes off, but that bug that goes... Has everybody seen it here? I mean, can I just mention that there's this connection between the bomb and the kind of idyllic 1950s?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of what we're getting here at is this, you know, the 50s end of the 60s.
The corruption of a young woman.
Okay. This is good, I think. You got the thing with, like, so Rita Hayworth was Gilda, and so that Gilda written on the, one of the first atomic bombs, right? There was this whole thing where they wrote Gilda on the bomb. It's where we get the term bombshell. If we call a woman a bombshell, it's because of this particular time where we wrote Gilda on an atomic bomb. And it was referencing Rita Hayworth in this film doing a song, Put the Blame on Mame, which is about blaming the female. So basically, it was like a kind of subversive, twisted psychological way to say, you know, woman is at fault for our sexual frustration, which is what this bomb essentially represents. And then Jessica Rabbit, to tie it back to Alice in Wonderland, did the response to that scene in Gilda that the bomb was referencing with Put the Blame on Mame, which is blame it on the female, with why don't you do right like some other men do? And so she was like calling the men out, being like, oh, we're going to, you know, back in the 40s or whatever, when Rita Hayworth sang the song, you know, she was like kind of being like, you know, submissive or whatever. Whereas Jessica Rabbit, who's like with, you know, Roger the White Rabbit, she's going to do this whole, but like, it's strange too, like Roger seems kind of young for Jessica Rabbit. I don't know. But anyways,
he's a mature rabbit.
Well, that takes us back to Paradise, Nabokov's Paradise, and the Fall of Man, which is what it's called. But it's interesting because in that story, it's Eve that's tempted by the snake, and it seems like we do put the blame on her. You know, like that was the traditional way that she duped Adam into eating the apple too. But really,
right? Which a lot of people just think is the subconscious. You know, you're just talking about the two sides of ourselves and what's actually, you know, the source of the influence. But yeah,
right, right. And that's what he plays up on in Ada as well. That these Ada and Vaughn are two halves of one person.
Right, and he writes it. What was it, Von Ada? Or
yeah, the A and then the A and the V interlaced as well.
Yeah. Huh.
I was just reading.
I think we see.
Oh yeah.
I just was saying, Lolita. We talked about this earlier, but there's definitely this element of the conniving or the kind of streetwise. Low. By the way, I like that name for her. Low. I thought that was a cool name.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, it relates to this Eve idea that there's this kind of, I don't know, Eve was more connected to the source of the deception in a way. And I mean, it feels like there's readings of that story that that allow for this kind of female street wisdom, or I don't know, that's might be the wrong phrase, noun phrase, but what you were saying, Doug, reminded me of our conversation earlier on this call. And I'm thinking about Me Too as well, because, you know, we clearly have a exploitation of women all the way through the present day. But like, how does this Me Too truth telling relate to this, you know, 2000, 4000, 6000 year characterization of females, where on the one hand they're blamed, but on the other hand there's a secretive kind of quality, and we don't talk about, like, they're blamed, but you can't talk about it either, or you get blamed in a way. And so there's this kind of they're accused for. Do you see what I'm saying? Sorry, I've lost my articulation here, but it's like you can't talk about it on the one hand, but at the other hand, there's this wisdom that a woman might have. You know?
This is the tool. It could be that this is the tool of repression. You know that. So, you know how we're talking about a cultural shift. You know, and so you're getting down to the bedrock there, where if we're going to liberate Eve, you know, so did we really put all the blame on her? You know, it wasn't really my fault. It's my wife. She tricked me into eating the apple.
I think the movie The Box has an interesting take on all this. With has anybody seen The Box?
It's been a while.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
That she pushes the button. It's like the button has been pushed. It's what. I don't know. I can't really extrapolate. I'm going to quickly pivot and say that, because you brought up low, and I just was reading the other day that in 1969 was when the very first computers that were going to make up ARPANET went online, so which would eventually become the internet. So basically, right at the start of the internet, they had two computers that were trying to communicate, and from one city to another or whatever. And the guy started typing in, and he was typing in log in to be the first message. And he's on the phone with the guy, and he types in L-O, and the thing crashes. So technically, the very first message that was ever sent on the internet is low.
But you remember the first thing that was projected in film or through a television?
Hitler.
Cook's tube. But what ultimately became television, but like the original prototype from Crooks, who was like Golden Dawn guy, he was trying to contact the other side, spirit world, and he projected a Templar cross. Uh-huh. And so the origin of television is ultimately from trying to contact the
other side. That makes so much fucking sense.
Is that Baird's? Is his name?
What's that?
Is his name Baird's?
No, I'm talking about the Crookes tube.
Oh, something okay. Crooks. Yeah. There's a guy Baird's who was one of the first technologists involved in television as well.
Oh, it's probably the next step, because I mean there was another tube that followed it that might be related to that, but it's the original conception came from this guy who was in who was a Golden Dawn guy. Yeah. That was, I don't know. I never know like how to like take what things are said of people on Wikipedia. Yeah. Like it's like kind of like the ultimate grain of salt for me. Like I'm like, I have a hard enough time considering what people say about me behind my back. Like I wouldn't want to know like after I was dead, like, you know, 100 years from now, what somebody in an open communication thing is going to have to say. So I don't know how much he believed in hokey spiritualism or like how, like, in how much depth I actually had. I mean, he invented what became television, so he probably had something going on. I don't know. But they kind of put him down in all the articles you'll read about him. Like, he was just really gullible or whatever, naive.
That sort of makes sense, because there was a the huge spiritualist movement, that everybody was involved in, like Yeats was involved in when he was in the Golden Dawn as well. It would make sense that somebody would try to create a technology to do that, to contact these spirits.
I think they succeeded, by the way.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Yeah, Doug, remember what you said?
What'd you say, Doug?
Doug?
Doug, do you remember what you said during Ada? Was this another book that you had recently read or an interview that you did?
Doug? He might not be here.
I think we lost Doug.
Okay.
Dougie. RG's down. I lost my RG.
He's just reverted to Dougie, and I can't speak.
I stepped away. I'm very sorry.
For a bite.
Fuck
this. I'm just eating chips over there.
That happened the last time.
I had to step away to pick up my 9-year-old daughter from the Nutcracker performance.
That's pretty. Really? You don't let her stay up to watch the Nutcracker? What?
No.
Another Russian musical connection. Yeah.
Well, that's Helena and Eyes Wide Shut.
Yeah.
Can I stay up late and watch the Nutcracker? You got it. I know who I'm talking to, but.
So I was just reading about on the wiki here again about the Camera Obscura, which is a Russian book Nabokov put out in 1932. And it's the one that he ties in with Alice in Wonderland and Ada, right? But it gets translated in 1936 as Laughter in the Dark. And it's also the book deals with the affection of a middle-aged man for a very young woman, resulting in a mutually parasitic relationship. In 1955, Nabokov used this theme again with Lolita to a much differently developed effect. So it's like direct forerunner of the whole thing.
You guys, there's that new, they found a script from Kubrick that was like in the same vein as Lolita.
Learning Secret.
There it is.
Young boy. Stefan Zweig novel.
Right, so that's like that's like Summer of 42, but there's a I don't know. There's another angle that it doesn't go well, right? I mean, because Summer of 42 goes pretty well. Everyone's happy. He goes on with his life. it's like a positive drug story. It's like don't give a pedophile story where everything doesn't go as shit for the person.
Normally the older person isn't Jennifer O'Neill.
Right. Summer of 42, great film, by the way. I've never seen the sequel to it, though. Class of whatever. I don't know. Class of 68? Something? I don't know. Whatever. But they met in real life, you know, that was based on a true story. And then that kid, like, on some show or something, they, like, connected. And there was, like, women pretending to be her. And then they actually found her. And it was this big reunion thing or whatever. I don't know.
Wow.
But yeah, that pairs with Pink Floyd, Adam Hart Mother. I just have to say that. If I don't, I'm, you know, betraying myself. But yeah.
You should watch that with Scanners. Cause Jennifer O'Neill is a weird... it's like she's in Summer 42. She's in Scanners, which came out 237 days after The Shining. And she's in The Shining because she's in Summer 42, which is in The Shining.
Dude, okay, hold on. Scanners came out 237 days after
The Shining.
The Shining, and the poster for it says 237 deaths?
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, God. That's awesome. Weird.
How many
days did Wayne's World come out compared to... Sorry. Isn't that scene, question. Scanners, where that dude's head blows up?
Yeah.
Scanners is a pretty awesome movie. What was it? I think it's the Bugs Bunny movie came out 237 days before The Shining. So,
tell me about that. That's interesting.
I forget what the movie's called, but it's like the Looney Tunes movie. I don't know that one.
Okay, so it was 237 days after. After what
after
came out
Shining.
That was
after 237.
No. Hold on, I'm trying to remember the other one with fucking Bean John Malkovich.
Oh, after
Kubrick died, 237 days after Kubrick died, Bean John Malkovich came out, starring John Malkovich, obviously, who pretended to be Kubrick in Color Me Kubrick.
Yeah,
so you have Bean John Malkovich, Color Me Kubrick, That's, yeah, there was some,
and,
I don't remember.
So, the thing about Scanners is at the very end of Scanners, the whole thing is that he transfers his mind into another person's body. They switch bodies, right? The mind of Cameron Vale goes into the mind of his demented brother.
Right.
Transfer of consciousness. And then Being John Malkovich is about all these people putting their minds into John Malkovich's head.
Heredity, too.
Hereditary. Fuck that movie.
So Heredity came out 6 days, or was it 5 days, to the anniversary of Rosemary's Baby?
Huh.
Which I'm saying because, like,
well, actually, Hereditary is
more relatable to Heredity than, like, any other film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Safe to say, I think.
Big. That was a huge thing for me. Because it's related
huge
to
Being for me too.
On the calendar, too. Because I fucking hate to bog down conversations with these numbers and shit. But 6,660 days after Being John Malkovich came out, Hereditary came out. So it's a 666 in between the two.
Dude, we need to exchange notes, Alex, because, you know, like, you drop things for me. I just know the fucking date of Rosemary's Baby. So I was like, whoa. And then a 50 year, like, and I'm like, 50 noon death, like, the actually.
12, right?
Yeah.
Because George Bush just died, and he was born on June 12th. David Rockefeller was born on June 12th. Lolita came out. It's weird. Lolita says now it came out June 13th or premiered June 13th, but
right.
For the longest time it said June 12th.
Yeah.
So June 12th is like a big day, it seems like.
I just saw something else June 12th today. So I spent a portion of the day trying to look into – oh, my God, dude. I'm never going to find it, but there's a movie called The Mao Game, which is the music's composed by Vivian Kubrick in 1999, same year that Eyes Wide Shut came out. And it's like, I don't even know, has she done anything actually since then? Because it seems like the stuff that I'm seeing that since then is just like her being referenced because they've used things that she's contributed to or whatever, like before. Because it's like, you know, she was essentially kidnapped by the Scientologists. Like she had to cut off all of her ties to friends and family and all this shit. Yeah, and I'm like, there's this movie called the Mao Game. It's like got Kirstie Alley in it or whatever. But like, I'm like, this is kind of weird. Like when you know what's going on in her life at that point, and then like it happens to be the same year that Eyes Wide Shut came out, and then also that you have the Scientologist couple who are having like a tumultuous marriage at the time of the filming of Eyes Wide Shut, while Kubrick can't contact his own daughter because of Scientologist. It's just like. It's totally bizarre, but like I wish I could find this movie, The Mao Game. It's like impossible, though. I think
the whole Vivian Kubrick story. It's funny her name's Vivian because we have Vivian Darkbloom in Lolita, and he used Vivian in his movies repeatedly. And in 2001, where she wants a Bush baby for Christmas, which is this weird sexual pun, and. You know, again, George Bush just died. But she's in The Shining too, in this very disturbing kind of background scene where she's at the party, the great, you know, the big party while Jack Nicholson's there. And she's watching Jack the whole time when he gets the avocado spilled on him. So he gets up and this woman with the blood-stained hand.
I didn't know Vivian was in that scene.
Yeah, she's right there. And it's, I don't know. There's a subtext to Vivian throughout his movies that's creepy as fuck.
Well, she was going to be a director. Like, she would have gone on to greatness if it wasn't for the variable of Scientology. And I'm like, dude, like, I've been tripping on this all day, and I almost don't want to share it because I'm trying to put something together where but it's basically that what is the real cheating going on in Eyes Wide Shut? In real life, because as that was going on, you have the head of Scientology was trying to basically create dissonance with Nicole Kidman and Tom Cruise, because they had first gotten him to break up with Mimi Rogers, whose father was a heavy-duty prominent Scientologist. And then so they did like Days of Thunder, and he, I guess Tom Cruise like chose Nicole Kidman for that, like, he influenced her mean in that movie because of this movie where she's with a naval officer in her, like, her breakthrough performance called, I think it's called Dead Calm. And then, like, where she's out at sea and there's this whole thing with this naval officer. And that was, like, her first big movie. Naval and then she's like,
naval whole, officer.
Yeah, the whole thing is with the naval officer. And I'm like, dude, fucking L. Ron Hubbard. And so, like today I listened to the book on tape of Dream Story just to make sure, like, because I'm writing this thing and I want to be accurate. And I'm like, it wasn't a naval officer. It was just an officer. Like, it wasn't specifying Navy in the book. Like, I'm always interested in the parts where you can see the influence because it's like, well, what's the significance of that? And I'm like, dude, like, in the midst of him not being able to see his daughter because of these people, and you have the Sea Org in Scientology and the whole naval aspect, the whole thing. And I'm like, what is the jealousy? Well, the jealousy, like,
it's not
what,
clear.
What is encoding? Like, it's not, it's because you, if you're like in the Sea Org, if you go, okay, so you get to the top and you sign a contract for 1 billion years. So, like, you're supposed to, like, when you come back, like, with your next lifetime, you still are having to work for Scientology. It's just, like, it's the most bizarre thing. But it's, like, that's, like, a marriage. Like, they're playing on the same thing. Like, a marriage is a contract. And they're, like, are you going to go against the contract? And it's, like, and I'm thinking of The Shining of, like, I signed a contract with these people, you know, like. And then Vanilla Sky, which is the other side of Eyes Wide Shut, because it comes from, you know, Open Your Eyes, that, I don't, guys, you know this whole thing with Vanilla Sky, like, it was the first film to be filmed at the Dakota since Rosemary's Baby, and the whole thing with it was Tom Cruise's very next movie, and it keeps the thing going. If you get the chance to listen to the director's commentary for Vanilla Sky, see how it relates to Eyes Wide Shut, it's totally mind-blowing. But anyways, I'm sorry, I don't want to take up too much space.
Your Love and Theft piece, David, was amazing. It really moved me. I love that record. And so when I saw your, you know, it's just uncanny. It's one for me that really confirmed the sync work that you've been doing, you know. Just if anybody's out there, I don't know where that's accessible. I think it's on thesyncbook.com.
Yeah, it's on my page. Yeah, my film page. But that one has the... I need to redo the ending of that one, actually. Like, just take out the last track and put in the soundtrack to the film. Because, like, I didn't used to do that. And then sometimes I'd realize afterwards where I'm like, oh, it's actually better that way. Because, like, the way he falls to his death and the timing of the way that track ends, like, is the way that it wants to be. But I'm using a lot of times, I'm matching it to the very end of the film. So you can't always see that unless if you, like, watch it sometimes, like, to the end of the credits, that's the end of the album. And so, like, it looks like I'm starting it for significant reasons related, like, symbolically or something. Because that's a really good example, because the album doesn't start for, like, I think 4 minutes or something. And I filled in the gap with like an interview with Tom Cruise talking about Eyes Wide Shut and all this stuff, you know. But anyways, yeah.
Hey, David, in your research, did you make any sort of connection to what was the allegations or whatever came up with Nicole Kidman's dad?
You know what? When I look at that, I don't, like, I'm not, I can't take a position because, like, I don't ultimately know, but I do know that when anything that relates to Scientology, like, and somebody who they consider what was the word? I need to pull up my text here because I was just writing about this. A suppressive person. So, like, he's considered by Scientology a suppressive person. Like, he's a threat to Scientology as stated by them. And so I'm just like, well, if there ever was a target for slander, he would be a good place to point, you know. Because they're in the midst. They're trying to break up a relationship between two people that they already helped bring together. They're fucking nuts, dude. Like, Scientology, get out of town. Like, you know, I don't know. I guess all I'm saying is that, like, I'll take that with more than a grain of salt for, like, shit that people want
to,
you know.
No, and I'm open to that, too. I was just curious if because that was such a crazy thing to hear, and,
I was only getting it from one source, and I kind of scoured the internet, and then everything kind of led back to the same person. And then I was like, okay, did this guy just, like, you know, of course there was that rumor. Yeah, I started that rumor once again. So, you know, I don't know. I just, I can't reject anything completely unless, you know, but I'm like, you know, innocent until proven guilty, I guess, you know?
There's but, just the connection to Lolita. I mean, is just to bring it back to Lolita here a little bit, is that there's this idea of the pedophile network that's behind the scenes and powerful people. And so it's just interesting that it comes up now in the Nicole Kidman context.
I mean, that's a thing everywhere, dude. Like, I'm sorry, but like, people are in the spotlight. Their lives are more of a focus for us. And like, we have gossip like within our own communities or whatever, but we can like, it's really, I don't know. There's a distinction between like wanting to hold people accountable and like, I'll notice like sometimes in certain circles, it's almost like people are getting off on like, oh, what dirty shit did you find on somebody? And I know that terrible things go on and like, that's a real concern. I'm not trying to negate that. And at the same time, I have like, I don't know. I just saw this thing on fucking Tom Hanks's Instagram where people were freaking out about him having a picture of a shoe and him being like, you know, that he's on the ground and then like a glove on the ground. And he's like, oh, somebody walking around with their cold feet or somebody walking. And, you know, it's like child shoe. And people are like, oh, my God, what a fucking sicko. He's taking pictures of abductees, articles of clothing or whatever. And people are all freaking out about it. And then I'm like, wait a minute. The man with one red shoe, it was like one of his first films. And I'm like, that was the whole thing when he finds the thing and he's like, oh, there's somebody out there without the, and it was just, I'm like, well, maybe, you know, you could, I guess, still argue if you really wanted to, that he's just using that as a means to communicate this other sick pedophile point. I'm like, you know what? Like, I need more substance before I'm going to break out my pitchfork and go to town on any particular.
Absolutely, no, but I'm just saying, in terms of a theme in a picture in a work of art, I mean, not every work of art is focusing on this theme. This is kind of a, you know, and I think with Lolita, we have a connection where these ideas are kind of explicit, this is a character in the film, you know, these networks in Eyes Wide Shut, this is an explicit reference. To this stuff. But what I was going to say was just that the movie The Master, and I wanted to relate this back to the Lolita conversation, there is this kind of childhood sexual trauma, let's say, that becomes a key factor in the character. I can't think of his name. Such a great character name. I wish I could remember the Joaquin Phoenix character, where he's sitting with the master and he goes right to sexuality and childhood sexual experiences. And that becomes kind of the focus of this network, this institution of Scientology, where the whole goal is to get people to divulge these secrets and then kind of hold it against them, then extract funds from them. But we were talking earlier about Arda, Ada, and how this Ada becomes Arda, a thing. Yeah, the 12-year-old, this experience. I think on the call you guys had, you alluded to it being autobiographical for Nabokov, and that maybe he was kind of dealing with his own experiences in this code of like a 1,000-page novel or something like that. So, I'm making a point more, David, here, not about like, are these things real or not, or like the absurdity of some of the accusations in the present, culture, but more of like how this can drive works of art, how there's some kind of fundamental aspect to like our humanity, even of mm-hmm. sexuality, and how that it seems to be a motive and like to build these, let's call them sandcastles or, you know, defense mechanisms. Like, we don't want to talk about sexuality. We want, and we like, there's artifices that are constructed to avoid these kind of these dark places. And so, you know, I know it's a little bit of a different point here, but I think that there's something really core and fundamental about sex, the sex instinct. And I know this show has talked a lot about the German-Austrian sex theorist from the 20th century. His name is Wilhelm Reich. But I mean, I don't know. I'm just trying to kicking it into this other space of like our sex drive being so fundamental for secrets, darkness, as well as kind of art. Construction, as well as obsessive kind of internet trolling. I kind of went over some ground there, but I do think, just to say, I mean, that I'm happy to see works of art just going to this place, because this isn't kind of coffee shop conversation. I mean, people aren't, you know, describing this stuff in the public sphere. And so these works of art are maybe release valves, or they at least add into the discourse this very fundamental topic, sex as exploitation, networks of power. You know, our own, like as a viewer, I was saying, I relate to Humbert. I mean, you mentioned to David, but I mean, this girl looks like an adult, and I felt kind of connected to Humbert and the tragedy that he went through, you know, as a narrative device that was, I thought, ingenious, because it's not like I'm disgusted with Humbert, you know.
The emotion you should be feeling if you were to entertain it as like a reality for Humbert, like if this was really happening to somebody, yeah. it's tragic and it's sad because his existence is sad because it's clinging to something to try and recreate from the past that it's never have again. It's basically like Dancing Queen. She's never going to be on that dance floor again. She's old. She's looking back. She's, you know, those days are done. She can't be that Dancing Queen again. It's like Humbert's position. He's like, I can't relive that because what was done was done. So it's really a story of deep regret and him trying to create a substitute of his like trying to project that into this girl, and so which means that it's making him like feel like he's like gonna like reconcile this knot that he can't quite reconcile, you know, because he it was the way that things played out and that's how it went, and he just can't come to terms with it or accept it. So it's his dysfunction and it's his neuroses. And it's like, it's hysterical. Like, it's funny if you just look at, like, you know, the way that things are relayed. But at the same time, it's also a complete fucking tragedy. Like, you're supposed to feel sorry for this person. That's why when they said that they're going to pull that from schools, you know, even for older kids or whatever, I'm like, what the hell are you talking about? It's not an advertisement for pedophilia. No. If anything, it's a warning and a statement on the fucking, the sad reality of things. So, you know.
But it was that stuck in his craw that made him do Ada. It's this order, his whole life, this burning for this moment when he was 14, and part of this book, part of Ada was this idea of the texture of time. And so it's interesting because there is something there that kind of McKenna lit onto as well. You know, I feel like I need to read Ada again because it was just too much.
Yeah, the whole thing that time is, to define time, we always try to define time in terms of space metaphors, but that time is actually the texture of things between marked events. And that's the only way that we can can get any sort of grasp on time. And that has to come through memory and the senses in this way of synesthesia that we've been talking about.
Or the internet and Wikipedia.
Yeah.
That sounds like cryptocubrology to me. The texture of time, that's the spaces between marked events, that's exactly what it is. It's about...
But he would be, like, instead of looking at from one event to another event and then counting the days, it would be the days in between. It would be the days in between that need to be experienced, right? if you put a midpoint, then it's like, then you've measured it again, you know? Anytime you measure it, it becomes space instead of time.
Right, I see what you're saying.
Well, Dennis mentioned in your talk, Dennis, I was really struck by something Dennis said in the talk about love being the kind of propulsion by which we experience reality. And it's almost like there's these vortexes of emotion, physical touch, that kind of are these markers of how we experience time and reality and just what you're saying there, Znor. But love and sex are key to this in a way, because what is more synesthetic than this experience?
Well, that's exactly right. Like the scene in Ada where eventually all three get together. It's the two sisters and then Vaughn. And then that's when he has the most explicit reference of synesthesia, where he says sounds have colors and colors have smells, you know, and it just becomes this mass of bodies, you know. But in an innocent way, you know, it's that before the fall, you know, it's before sexuality becomes.
You did a good job convincing me, Znor, but he's still an old perv, okay?
Well, no, sure he is, but you can't. at the basis of being an old perv, even the worst old perv, there's probably a little bit of that there, you know, which I think this is what SJ is maybe talking about as well. Like there's something behind that that is not all evil, you know. It gets twisted and it gets distorted in the way that Reich and other people talk about, right? But if you go back far enough, I don't know, in time or whatever, however you want to define that, or back far enough in your own psyche, you can still find this kind of kernel of innocence there. It's just the pure drive of life, you know. It's the same sort of innocence that birds have when they chirp in the morning every morning when the sun comes up, you know.
And there's a certain inevitability, and like I'm thinking about McKenna and this idea of the great attractor. That's not his exact phrase, but there was the idea of the attraction, that something right. is compelling us forward into it by its power. Right? And I think that sex, that's another way of saying sex. I mean, especially when you're virile and young and nubile and all exactly. of these things. I mean, yeah. I mean, you go to a bar. I'm just saying, I'm 20, you know, I remember in my 20s, I step into a bar and it's just like, you can watch. I remember I took some mushrooms in Portland, actually, Alex, in 2008. And I took these mushrooms and went out to the bar, and it was the first warm evening after a winter, a really harsh winter that winter. So this was early 2009. I walked into the bar and it wasn't a heavy dose. It wasn't a heroic dose, but it was enough to kind of, you know, get a bird's eye view of what was happening. And I was so struck by just this biological, attraction that people don't even understand. I mean,
I had the exact same experience, you know. It's just like going into a bar and the same thing, being dosed, and then just seeing this motivation behind everybody, all these different schemes going on and how complex it was, you know.
I've done that. Yeah, I did that in San Francisco with Cyan Essence. So like the Cyan Essence are like the little black ones, not like Cubenzies, the like long, you know, the longer white ones, whatever. I don't know. It's interesting because you can see all the layers of psychic communication that are right. happening all the time. But like I like to go to mundane type things sometimes. I don't care. But like there was a time in my life where I'd really like to experiment with like applying something of profundity to something mundane, which is interesting. Like, I wouldn't have thought to define synchromysticism as Jake Kotze. I asked him once and he told me that I didn't retain it. I need to listen to that recording again. Anyways, that he'd do this thing where he like go out to some sacred site in the snow, sit around a fire on ayahuasca all night, but then like the next day like watch a Jim Carrey movie and like see depth of things, but where he's like basically saying to look in the mundane to see the, how does he phrase it exactly? I should know that.
Well, wasn't that what David Lynch used to do? He used to sit in the Glendale Galleria food court and watch people.
Right. I mean, there's people watching, you know, but then there's like, you know, where you're taking something that you would apply normally to something really, you know, you're like, I'm going to go to a fucking Pink Floyd concert and eat this acid. You're not like, I'm going to go to the library and like eat this acid. You know, like it's a different, you're going to have a different experience, but depending on your orientation and what you're like, in other words, if you were looking deeply enough, you could find the same thing in a leaf that you could in a Jim Carrey movie. But
well, that's exactly, you know, so what, like,
it's not about the thing. It's about where you're looking from, I guess, or, you know, it's
that's
a vantage
exactly
point.
What Ulysses is all about, that, you know, finding the mythical. Finding the mythical in the everyday, you know.
I will say, the first time. Go ahead.
Philip K. Dick has the thing I always say, which is that, you know, God is, or Ubik is, not only lives in the trash, in the gutter, but he is the trash in the gutter.
Right.
So, you know, my worst book is my best book, and the worst movie is still a fragment of the same substance that animates everything, and you can, depending on how you look, just like Dave said, that, you know, you can get, I had the most, one of the more profound experiences watching Baby Geniuses, Baby Geniuses 2, Super Babies.
It wasn't
ever made. It was literally, I think I watched it literally because it was on the IMDb worst. I think it was like 66 worst movie ever. And I just saw all this fucking stuff in it that was, it blew my mind at the time. So it's like, yeah, I am totally with Jake Kotze on that. Although, yeah, no, I won't say anymore. Go ahead, Esther.
I was just going to say, the first time I ever took LSD, I was 16. I got these, like, back at this time, it was like sugar cubes with like colored dyes, and I was alone, and I didn't even know what I was getting into. I mean, it wasn't a party thing. I mean, I got it, I took it, and I rented on VHS Dazed and Confused and Pink Floyd's The Wall.
And, what a stereotype. It was
a total stereotype. But so I put on Dazed and Confused, and my big takeaway was, this is so fucking fake. Like, I remember watching and thinking, this is clearly just actors. Yeah. I mean, there was the human element that was clearly not present, some kind of fundamental human quality that was removed from the acting. And so I'm not saying that Kotze is wrong or anything like that, but it's just, it's amazing. And then The Wall seemed more real to me, you know, and maybe it was the music quality, but The Wall isn't like the pretense of verisimilitude. You know what I'm saying? It's more of it is art, and it knows it's art. Whereas film, there's this appearance of, this is a real interaction. You know, that's what a film tries to convey. So anyhow, I just thought it was funny, 'cause we talked about, McConaughey earlier. And I actually went to the middle school that was filmed at. That's my middle school. Anyhow, just a personal anecdote there about this LSD thing.
It's fascinating when there's the art, and then there's the reality, and when you have the bleed over, I'm fixated on that. Like, I find that fascinating. So, like, if you have a personal element in something, you know, yeah. There's like at my high school, there was a film with Keanu Reeves and Kiefer Sutherland that was like made for TV, called The Brotherhood of Justice, like about these like vigilante guys that like beat up the bullies. So they're basically, it's kind of like a Robin Hood kind of thing almost. It's like, you know, they're gonna get back at the people who are being shitty. So they themselves end up become like the oppressed become the oppressors kind of thing that goes on there. It's interesting because I watch that now, and it has this whole, it imbues it somehow. But like, you know, you're seeing this fake and Dazed Confused because you're being objective, you know, and that gives you an opportunity to look at something from another angle that you otherwise wouldn't, because you're not absorbed in it in the same way. You're absorbed into something else. And then you can kind of, you know, and it's funny, you'll see sometimes really deep things, but they'll seem like, as you're seeing them, like a given when you're in altered places, and you're like, oh, well, yeah. And then you're like, wait a minute, no. And the rest of my life, generally, I wouldn't recognize that in that way. You know, it's like the profound sometimes becomes commonplace. Because there's also like that feeling like this is just the way reality is now. And like, that's why like sometimes when people are high, they like forget that, oh, yeah, I'm going to come down eventually. Like, it just seems like, oh, this is what life is. Everything I can see the patterns in everything, you know.
But I think there's also an element to this, to the Kubrick project, let's call it that, because if you want to assume that there's a disclosure side of the Kubrick project, you know, disclosure of like the inner workings of the power structure, let's just phrase it like this, you know, it's similar. You have that similar effect from watching his pictures, because you're like, whoa, what the fuck is this? I'm seeing reality in a whole new way. I'm seeing, you know, maybe pedophile networks or unreality, whatever. I'm seeing this kind of Kubrickian model of disclosure. And I think that there's a similarity there of waking up from seeing his pictures. And you don't need to be dosed, I mean, to get that. I mean, you know, you just have to watch the movies like 100 times with the DVD player.
You know? You remember Kubrick's favorite William S. Burroughs quote, where he said that a paranoid schizophrenic is somebody who's begun to realize what's actually going on, or something very similar.
Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. I think I just broke the flow.
No. That was my. I didn't have another point beyond that. No, I think. I mean, I just think that's astute on something, you know, that we don't get in the everyday consciousness. You know, you don't get at the Starbucks in the morning or wherever. You know, hey, how are you doing? I'll take a latte. And pedophile networks run reality, and there's a code to time that is kind of overriding. You know, I mean, these things don't come up.
What are you going to do when you get a platform and you know something? What are you going to do? If you want to keep the platform,
yeah,
it's got to be the fucking most insane position. And then to know how much blackmail and all the shit that goes on, it's got, and you don't know which is which and who is who in that realm, because it's like, what would you do if you got privy to some heavy shit? And you're like, well, here I am. Do I want to have the my family, friends, and family potentially die over this? Do I want to like have at least, at the very least, your name's fucking slandered and whatever? You don't know. Like, you know, it's crazy when you think about that angle. And then I'm like, also like, what kind of fucking placation is this to throw the entertainers at the people when we know goddamn well that the people actually running actual policy and shit are up to like probably far worse. And then it's like, oh, so you handed us fucking, you know, I don't know. It gets weird at that point, because it's like, is that what entertainment is for? Like, you have this bread and circus, like, as it's like a shell, so that like when we want to like want to appease the public and give them a sense of satisfaction of, oh yeah, at least something's being taken care of, and then like take certain people and like fucking imbue them to the max as like the devil, so we're just like, oh, so we can kind of like get off on it in this weird kind of way, and then be like, oh yeah, good, we took care of him, fuck him, he's out of the village. And it's like, you know, we're just voting people off the island who are like standing in between us and the actual controllers. What the fuck? I'm sorry.
Yeah, totally.
Why do we go after the artist first? Fucking A. So I do a soapbox thing here, but I find it, like, I'm not saying, like, artists can be fucked up, but at the same time, I'm like, you're holding up a mirror, and we're going to attack the people with the mirror because they're doing, like, I mean, what,
Yeah, exactly. It seems like they are our scapegoats, right? Like,
I went and I saw Marina Abramović's exhibit in Stockholm, like, year before last. And it was amazing. And like every single person that I talked to that talked great, you know, like really angry about Marina Abramović, nobody knew her art. They knew a couple things that were on the internet or whatever, but like everything that I described that I saw, like with the propaganda vehicle and what the kids were singing with the UN speech and like the satire, like she was in a car accident, so she had all these paintings of car wrecks that she was like, but she's all about reconciling trauma. But then she was also like pointing out the way that fucking propaganda works and how like it was very like deep and it was very subversive. But I didn't find anything evil. I found like she was like trying, like it was like a statement of like exposure. And then I'm like, well, people are attracted to her art. She's not responsible for who's attracted to her art. Mm-hmm. If you're a son of a bitch and you like a certain artist because you're looking at it in a certain way, I mean, that speaks on them, not necessarily the art. Like, I don't know. She could be fucking evil as shit and she's a witch and I don't even know what the hell I'm talking about. I just took what
well,
I
just because someone's art, I mean, I don't fucking know. Someone's art being great doesn't preclude their being a fucked up person. And often it actually necessitates being a bit of a fucked up person, because that's where all that's like. Kevin Spacey is a good example. When you read about his childhood being like totally horrifically abused by his like Nazi father, it kind of makes sense that he would grow up to be an abuser and a creep.
Michael Jackson, fucking A.
Sure.
Yeats talked about that. There's a choice about the perfection of the work or the perfection of the self, and sometimes, if you want the perfection of the work, you have to sacrifice yourself, right? In not very nice ways, you know?
That's very astute, yeah. Mm.
When they had the earthquake in San Francisco back in 1906, they said that old Mother Nature was up to her old trick. That's the story that went around, but here's the real lowdown. Put the blame on Maine, boy. Put the blame on Maine. One night she started to shim and shake. That brought on the Frisco quake. So you can put the blame on Maine, boy. Put the blame on Maine.